Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 369 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, we're going to be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is actually going to be Series 70. This is episode 369, Series 70. Again, it's going to be a short podcast. We're going to focus on some really high yield things that tend to be tested on these exams. Again, if you're taking the USMLE Step 2 CK or Step 3 or Complex Level 2 or 3 exams anytime within the next 1 month, I do have an MBME Test Taking Strategies course taking place on the 21st of this month from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. And if you also want a pretty good thorough review, I have a 24-hour review course taking place between the 22nd to the 25th of February. And if you're taking your USMLE exams in the summer, I do have a Divine Intervention Step 2 CK School. Obviously, it also applies to Step 3 and Complex Level 2 and 3. It's going to be 75 hours. It's going to be taking place between the first 2 weeks of May. If you're interested, that actual one has a 40% cap on the number of people that can attend. So I can, very deeply invest in everyone that attends. If you're interested in any of those courses, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information. All the courses are going to be held through Zoom. Okay, so let's begin. So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, she's a 24-year-old female, she's gravida one, this is maybe her first, or let's say this is her first pregnancy, let's make it easy, right? This is her first pregnancy, she's never had a kid before, and they tell you that, she was diagnosed with hyperemesis gravidarum 4 days ago, and they told her to take, vitamin B6 and doxylamine and eat small frequent meals for her hyperemesis gravidarum. Right. And then they tell you that over the last 2 hours, she's been having very severe, very significant chest pain. Right. And then they say, what's the most likely diagnosis? Right. If they ask you for the most likely diagnosis, I would really hope you're saying, Divine, looks like this woman has ruptured her esophagus. Right. So the thing is, obviously, this person has ruptured their esophagus. That's bad. Right. Now, the thing is, most times for these people on exams, they're just going to ask you, what are you going to do in terms of treatment? Well, remember, whenever you rupture something in the body, your next best step is pretty much always going to be to go to surgery, right? Pretty much always going to be to go to surgery, depending on the part of the body that has been junked up, right? So if, for example, it's your abdomen that has been messed up, it'll be like some kind of laparotomy. If it's your thoracic cavity that has been messed up, remember, your esophagus is predominantly your thoracic cavity. You're going to do a thoracotomy, right? You're going to do the OMI procedure, like the OMY, thoracotomy, laparotomy, whatever, right? Remember, since it's the chest, it's going to be a thoracotomy. You use cotomies, right? Or, otomies, whatever, whenever you're trying to incise into a specific cavity in the body, right? So since this is the chest, you're going to be doing a thoracotomy, right? But if for whatever reason on the offhand they say, they want you to pick a diagnostic test for this patient. Well, whenever you suspect that a person has ruptured the esophagus, what are we going to be doing for those people? Well, typically what you're going to be doing in general is you're going to do a gastrographic enema, right? You're going to do esophagography, but you're going to use water-soluble contrast, right? Water-soluble contrast. Again, remember, another name for water-soluble contrast is gastrographing. In general, if you suspect that a person has ruptured the esophagus, using barium is a terrible idea on MBME exams because barium can cause a very powerful mediastinitis, and that will obviously not be a very good thing for the patient. It's almost like you're creating a fresh new set of problems for the patient, which is, probably not the smartest thing in the world to do, right? So there is that. So this person, you're going to do water-soluble contrast enema or gastrographic enema, and you're going to see extravasation into the thoracic cavity, right? That tells you that, again, they've ruptured some kind of viscous, and obviously your next step, again, is going to be exploratory thoracotomy, right? So again, just as a quick reminder, what are the indications for XLAP, right? So let's go to the abdomen. What are the indications for a person getting exploratory laparotomy on MBME exams? Again, there are many classic reasons, right? The classic ones they love to test on exams. First things first, if a person has like a signs of peritonitis, right? So what are signs of peritonitis? If a person has like rebound, right? If a person has like guarding, right? If a person has like severe abdominal tenderness, exquisite abdominal tenderness, right? Those are situations where you need to go ahead and proceed to XLAP. Now, some people say, oh, Divine, if a person has absent bowel sounds, that's peritonitis. No, that is not peritonitis. Let me tell you this. A person can have peritonitis and have absent bowel sounds, but it's not every person that has absent bowel sounds that has peritonitis. Let me explain. How do you differentiate between those two things? Let me be a better question here. The way you're going to differentiate between those two things on exams is ask yourself this. Does this person have absent bowel sounds in the context of other signs of peritonitis, like rebound tenderness, guarding? Then yes, they do have peritonitis. But if they just have absent bowel sounds and you don't see any of those other classic signs and symptoms of peritonitis, you cannot say that the person has peritonitis with any kind of definitiveness on MBME exams. Now, what are some other indications for XLAP? Well, some other indications for XLAP are going to be things like penetrating trauma to the abdomen, right? Penetrating trauma to the abdomen, right? So what are some things that can cause penetrating trauma? Well, if, for example, you have like a stab wound, right, to the abdomen, or you have like a gunshot, right? Things that are physically penetrating, foreign bodies, they're literally penetrating through your skin and into your abdominal cavity. That's going to be an indication for exploratory laparotomy. And then another thing that may also buy you this XLAP is if you have free air under the diaphragm, right? Free air under the diaphragm. So if, for example, you get a chest X-ray and you notice that, wow, I'm seeing this lucency under the diaphragm, that tells you that many times it's going to be linear. That tells you, oh, gee, this is free air. Well, that air did not just show up out of thin air. No, it's not air you swallowed. No, it came because you ruptured a viscous, right? So because you ruptured that viscous, that tells you that, oh, no, this person has perforated something, right? So those people need XLAP, right? Another classic one is if you see like blood, right? Like blood just pulling somewhere in the person's abdominal cavity. Well, blood does not just pull in the abdominal cavity for funsies. No, the blood pulled because a vessel ruptured or an organ ruptured, right? Many times it's the organ rupturing that then messes up the vessel and then you start bleeding out. In those circumstances, that person also needs XLAP, right? And again, if you rupture something, right? And the thing is sometimes, because the MBMEs, they know that most people these days have kind of caught on to, oh, you rupture something, so you get XLAP. Right? So they're beginning to use more creative surrogates of rupture to see if you can still catch on to the fact that, this person ruptured something, right? So like, for example, they love to give these questions where a person, you know, has shortness of breath, right? And then you're doing, you think that, maybe you put a chest tube of some sort or whatever, right? And you place the chest tube and you start getting bile out of the chest tube. I don't know. Chest tubes are not supposed to be returning bile, right? Bile is an intra-abdominal fluid, right? It's something you get from the duodenum and later, right? So if you're pulling out bile, right, from a person's thoracic cavity, I don't know, this person's diaphragm has probably ruptured. Right? So again, that would be an indication for exploratory laparotomy. And another classic one they also love to do on exams is they'll give you some person that has had some kind of surgery, right? And most times the surgery is going to be intra-abdominal in nature, right? And then you notice that the person is having signs of peritonitis after they've had surgery, right? So it can be like, for example, a person that has like Crohn's disease or a person that has ulcerative colitis, where, you know, you cut out some part of the abdomen. Many times it's going to be the colon or the small bowel. And then you do like an end-to-end anastomosis. Well, the thing is, if you're connecting something together, then there is the potential complication that you did not connect those things as well as they should, right? So the person has like an anastomotic leak, right? This is many times something that you get again from you know, like colon or small bowel surgery or like biliary surgery, right? When you see those things, you see a person having peritonitis after abdominal surgery, you really want to think of them either bleeding into their abdomen or they have like an anastomotic leak of some sort, right? Even bile can cause peritonitis, right? Those are all situations where you're going to go ahead and do an exploratory laparotomy. And again, remember, exploratory laparotomy can have many different means, right? Especially based on the branches of the branches of the ureter that supply the gut, right? Probably like the common one I think I've seen that you love to test on exams, right? Is like a ciliotomy, right? Sometimes instead of calling it an exploratory laparotomy, they'll call it an exploratory ciliotomy. Well, where did the word ciliotomy come from? I don't know. Maybe because the key blood supply of the foregut is the celiac artery, right? Remember, the blood supply of the foregut is the celiac artery, of the midgut is the superior mesenteric artery, of the hindgut is the inferior mesenteric artery, right? So those are all situations where you're like, okay, we're going to go ahead and do an exploratory laparotomy. Again, I just really wanted you to have a solid basis. Basically, if you know these scenarios I just discussed, I'll be really surprised if you somehow fail to get those things right on your test. Okay, now, next thing I want to talk about are, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, for the last 5 days, she has been having like worsening abdominal pain, right? And the pain is kind of diffuse and she has not had any bowel movements and she has been having a lot of vomiting and a lot of nausea. If you see something like that, what should you be thinking about on MBME exams? Well, I really hope you're saying, huh, Divine, This person has a small bowel obstruction, right? This person has a small bowel obstruction, right? Remember, small bowel obstructions, most times, it will present with a person having nausea, vomiting, right? No bowel movements, right? For a while, right? And they'll feel bloated, right? Those are all classic signs and symptoms. Now, what are the things that typically cause these small bowel obstructions? Well, there's a bunch of stuff that can cause these small bowel obstructions, right? The most common one, right? The biggest risk factor for small bowel obstruction is going to be an adhesion from prior surgery, right? From prior abdominal surgery. Again, sometimes they may even give you like a prior surgery, like a hysterectomy, right? As the thing that was the tipping point that years later then caused their problems, right? So if you have any kind of surgery below the diaphragm, those things can increase your risk for having, in fact, they are the most common causes. They're the biggest risk factor for a small bowel obstruction, right? Well, what are some other things that can cause this problem? Well, hernia. Remember, hernia is actually the second most common cause of a small bowel obstruction. Remember, a hernia can become incarcerated, right? Because most times hernias, it's not a big deal because, you know, they can pop out and then you can pop them back in, right? You can reduce the hernia. When a hernia is reducible, not a big deal, right? But a hernia starts becoming a big deal when it's no longer reducible, right? Where it's no longer reducible, right? In that case, you have an incarcerated hernia, right? But then when a hernia becomes irreducible, right? You can't reduce it anymore. And then you cut off blood supply to the parts of bowel that have herniated, right? Then you have a strangulated hernia. A strangulated hernia and a castrated hernia, those are both surgical emergencies, right? Those are both surgical emergencies. Those things can cause small bowel obstructions, right? Obviously, if you have necrosis, right, then you need to, because most small bowel obstructions, all you need to do is just do like a nasogastric tube. But sometimes nasogastric tubes don't work because the person has had like bowel necrosis, right? In those circumstances, you're going to go ahead and do exploratory laparotomy so you can cut out that dead bowel, right? And remember, just as an extra tidbit, before I keep on talking about the causes of a small bowel obstruction, remember, femoral hernias are not, because most hernias, you can be like, you know what, let's go ahead and do watchful waiting. Well, not all the time. For femoral hernias, which will occur in a female, right? Remember, femoral in females, right? Femoral hernias, you're not going to do watchful waiting, right? Those things, you're going to go ahead and schedule the surgery so that you can fix it. Most times, those femoral hernias, they're going to be in females, and they're going to be under the inguinal ligament, right? Those things can, they have a very high risk of incarceration and strangulation, so you don't wait on those hernias, right? Now remember, cancers are the third most common cause, right? So I said the most common cause of an SBO is going to be an adhesions from prior abdominal surgery, right? The second most common cause is going to be a hernia. Third most common cause is going to be cancer, right? Third most common cause is going to be cancer. Cancer, right? Colon cancer, small bowel cancers, gastric cancers, these things can all cause a person to have a small bowel obstruction, right? But again, our friends at the MBMEs, they know that most people that have the job description, medical student, have memorized that, the most common cause of small bowel obstructions is adhesions. Second most common cause, hernias. Third most common cause, cancers, right? So what are they doing these days? Again, they're becoming more and more creative, right? Again, sometimes they try to see your understanding of pharmacology and they throw it as a small bowel obstruction question, right? So you want to make sure for MBME exams that you know the drugs that love to cause SBOs, right? Basically, these are drugs that grind your GI tract to a halt. For example, if you're taking a drug that has anticholinergic properties, because again, you know, they know that everybody knows that opioids, right? They grind your GI tract to a halt, right? Because you have reduced like contraction, right? So you can have all those problems. But the MBMEs, they know that many people, unfortunately, don't know the specific drugs that have anticholinergic properties, right? So anticholinergic drugs are things on MBME exams that can cause two major problems. One, they can cause a small bowel obstruction. Two, right? So basically, it's not more of an obstruction. It's more of an ileus. Let me put it that way. It's more of an ileus, right? So the whole bowel usually will be involved, right? And then the second major problem caused by anticholinergic drugs is delirium, right? Delirium, right? So what are these drugs? Well, the classic ones, they can give you like cold medicine questions. That's going to be diphenhydramine, for example, right? Diphenhydramine is cold medicine. It can absolutely positively cause a small bowel obstruction. I mean, it can cause ileus, right? Because it has anticholinergic properties, right? Another thing that can also cause a similar problem on exams, right? You know, things like those first generation low potency antipsychotics, right? Those things have anticholinergic properties, right? So things like chlorpromazine, chlorpromazine, chlorpromazine can absolutely cause a small bowel obstruction, right? It can cause an ileus. And also another drug that can cause it an ileus on exams, right? Think about your tricyclic antidepressants. Remember, your tricyclic antidepressants, they have these things I love to call anti-HAM side effects, right? The H stands for antihistamine, so they can cause sedation. The A stands for anti-alpha-1 effects, right? So they can cause orthostatic hypotension. And then the M stands for anti-muscarinic, right? So they have these anti-muscarinic effects. Again, these drugs can certainly cause ileus on NBME exams. Right? So again, those drugs, right? You want to keep these drugs at the back of your mind for exams. And also the calcium channel blocking medications, right? Those calcium channel blockers, they love to cause small bowel obstructions on exams, right? Like your amlodipine, for example. Because remember, your GI tract is lined with smooth muscle. It's lined with all these muscle cells. You need calcium, even those neurons, for them to work. The neurons that you find in your myenteric nerve plexi. Right? You need calcium for those things to work properly. Remember, many times before you squirt out neurotransmitter at a synapse, right? Most times you're going to need calcium coming in through those voltage-gated calcium channels at the synapse, right? So that you can then squirt out neurotransmitter. Well, if that doesn't happen, right? Those neurons don't work, right? You have like impaired GI motility, right? So calcium channel blockers can absolutely on exams cause a small bowel obstruction, right? Now, the last classic thing that can cause small bowel obstructions on exams are people that have like chronic ulcers of some sort. This is like a classic one many people are actually not really aware of these days, right? So they have like a chronic ulcer of some sort, right? So what's this chronic ulcer? You can have it like from chronic GERD, right? You can have it from like if you have like peptic ulcer disease from like H. pylori, like even in your duodenum or in your stomach, right? Or you can even have a chronic ulcer because you have like an ulcerating disease like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, right? Whenever you see small bowel obstructive symptoms in people that have a history of UC or Crohn's, it's from an ulcer, right? Many times in some unfortunate cases, ulcers can heal with strictures, they can heal with fibrosis, and those strictures, that fibrosis can cause a small bowel obstruction, right? And when you get that small bowel obstruction, you're absolutely going to have symptoms. So again, if you kind of keep these things at the back of your mind, I think you should be very good with answering small bowel obstruction questions on your exam. Right. So if you know these things I just talked about, you should be very good from the perspective of answering small bowel obstruction questions on your exams. Right. And again, in general, small bowel obstructions, you don't have to do anything gangbusters. Right. What are the things you generally need to do for these people on exams? Well, the very first thing you should do is just do nasogastric, you place an NG tube, right? A nasogastric tube. Look at the name, nasogastric, right? They will decompress the bowel. Right. But if those, and many times you also want to fix the electrolyte abnormalities, right? Just give them potassium. Many times by giving those people potassium, that can help. Hypokalemia has a very strong association with many of these small bowel obstructions, right? Has that very, very stronger association, right? But again, obviously, if all those things don't work or they start, and actually, let me say one thing. Remember, you're going to see air fluid levels, right, on an abdominal x-ray. Most times for small bowel obstructions, just get an abdominal film and you'll see those air fluid levels, right? You'll see those air fluid levels, right? Most times in those circumstances, right, that's what you're going to see on imaging, right? But again, if you notice that the person starts getting really bad, let's say they start developing like a really bad lactic acidosis, they start crashing and burning from a hemodynamic stability perspective, then in those circumstances, right, they start having signs of like peritonitis, then you need to go ahead and consider surgery in those people. Okay, so I think what I'm going to do, since this is a rapid review podcast, I really have this goal of trying to keep these things 20 minutes or less. I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one, step two CK, and step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. I also offer these review courses, right? I have the MBME test taking strategies course, I have the 24-hour review course, I have those taking place this month. And then in the summer, I have the 75-hour step two CK, step three school that's going to be taking place. That one has a 40% cap. And then I have these podcasts on all the major podcast apps, right? Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you want to subscribe, you see the most recent 150 podcasts. If you want everything from episode 1 up to this episode, episode 369, then you want to go on the website divineinterventionpodcast.com. If you actually have a WordPress account and you subscribe to my website, whenever I make a new podcast, you'll get an email notification. And then I also have a new website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Many people have told me, oh, Divine, I really love the life lessons you put at the end of your podcast. So I decided to make a new podcast website, DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com, where it's just Bible-based teaching. So it's based on the Bible. Most of these things are like 10 to 15 minutes long. And they just address like a particular problem that's, common to humanity. And I use a biblical perspective to you know, describe the problem and explain how to counter those problems. I add like 2 podcasts roughly every week. Right now, I think I'm almost at episode 60 for those. And actually, I also have the podcasts on Apple Podcasts. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So I also have, you know, YouTube channel called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcast and Videos. That's where I post the videos that I make, and I make quite a few every now and then. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I wish you all the very best on your exams, and congratulations to those that got their scores today, their passing scores. And for those that are participating in the match, I'll encourage you, you know, if you're telling programs that they're your number one program, you want to go ahead and throw out that send that information to them sometime soon, right? You don't want to be sending it like at the very end of this month when the committee has already made their decisions, right? They're not going to be adjusting their rank list because of your email. No, right? So if you want to send that information across, it's usually a good idea to do it like 2 weeks or thereabouts ahead of the match deadline. So thank you for listening to me. Have a wonderful day. I will see you in the next podcast, and God bless you. Thank you.